And certainly China is in a situation where it has no environmental or very little environmental controls on what it's doing, and so a lot of industrial waste pollution and so on and so forth. So all that may be the case, it's just that I can't predict it. I mean, I can't really guess. It's certainly bad, that's right. As far as the business of the new monastic individual, the reason that I really didn't want to get into that, and with this young person, I didn't want to say, oh, well, that's the route for you to take, is that when I discussed that in the twilight of American culture, that the new monastic, what I call the new monastic option, is an individual solution, and in that sense, not a solution. In other words, structural problems require structural solutions. This is sociology 101, you know. If you're reduced to individual responses of cultural preservation, which is what I talk about in that book, it's very positive for the individual that does it, and I certainly advocate doing that. I mean, I think those are good things. But I don't think that they really can amount to changing the whole system because they're individual responses. In fact, when you're reduced to individual responses, it means you've largely given up on the structure. So again, I come back to the issue, which is what I was trying to say to him, show me the levers of power. It's not that I'm saying to him or that young fellow in Boulder or something like that, don't do what you have to do. I mean, you only live once, you might as well give it your best shot. But as an historian slash sociologist or whatever, I have to say that you have to look at, in terms of change, what are the levers of power? They don't seem to be anywhere today. They seem to have disappeared from the scene, you know? So that's the problem with the monastic thing.
Right, well, yeah. I mean, the hope there wasn't that, it's like you're saying, that not changing the structure, but that functioning as a seed bank, so to speak,
yeah,
for when the collapse does come, there's going to be something left there.
Why not? Why not?
And the other, one more thing, since I got you here, your other books, The Reenchantment of the World, and also
Coming to a Sense
of Nomadic Spirituality.
Yeah.
But anyway, you get into those about this fundamental fault, you know, of how we're so divorced and separated from nature. And I'm wondering, is that part of our problem here in the dark ages of America?
That, again, is the ecological question. But just very, very briefly, with all regard to those books, they're hopeful in a certain way about the nature of the human spirit. And that's something I'm very optimistic about. Remember, the United States is only 6% of the world's population. It's a very small percentage of the total land mass. And it's only been around for 230 years. It's not the be-all and end-all of existence. And the world will survive after the United States passes from the scene. It's just that, in other words, there may be hope elsewhere. So those larger pictures are about the human spirit, where it might be, and so on. It's just the United States, it seems to me, has finally painted itself into a corner. Woman here.
I just want to say, when I worked on a smaller version of systemic change, one of the heartening things for me was the learning that critical mass is 12%.
Uh-huh.
And so if I could change 12% of my teaching staff, I could change the whole school.
Uh-huh.
And it did. And yeah. So if there is hope for me, is to get 12% of the people of the country to become truly activists, mm-hmm, and not bourgeois activists. And I count myself in the group that's waiting for the rise, because I don't see how I'm going to make it happen. But 12% is not that much.
Well, I don't know if those figures... Right, right. But there are all these... They call them set theory and group dynamics. And it's true that for within certain limits, 12% is a crucial factor. I don't know if that still applies for very large, hundreds of millions of people, that it's 12%. I don't know, and I'm sure somebody did it. The one problem is that you can't do actual experiments on this. You know what I mean? You can't do civilizational experiments. You can do group study experiments, you know, and things like that. But it may be, one might say, well, with a certain percentage of the United States moving in a particular direction. The only thing is, I mean, the great example to me would be the New Deal. In the wake, after all, you had people demonstrating in the streets. I mean, you know, and when the dust settled on the New Deal, most historians agree, it just preserved capitalism. That's basically what it did. It was finally nice, but no great shakes. It did not move the country in a profoundly different direction. And in fact, we've been unraveling it ever since FDR's death, you know. So somebody had a question. Yes.
You know, I guess there's nothing wrong with any economy as long as there is justice. And so capitalism isn't a problem. Justice within capitalism is.
Well, it's a problem then of distribution. And capitalism, as has been well said, is very good for accumulating wealth. It's not so good for distributing it. And we don't have mechanisms of distribution, especially in this country.
Well, it would be good if somebody would say, well, it would be just to give somebody this wage for this job instead of this wage. Mm-hmm.
There are also simply no examples of a rich socialist economy. That's an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. It's never existed.
Well, you know, something like Scandinavia does pretty well.
It's not a socialist economy. Not even 50% of the economy is under state control.
Yeah, but it's not purely socialist. I certainly agree with you there. But it's a social welfare system, and it distributes a whole lot better.
An advanced form of feudalism, as you well described.
Pardon?
An advanced form of feudalism, as you well described.
Well, you know that. Yeah, Danes I meet are quite delighted with it, I have to tell you. Scandinavians I meet are not in opposed to their system, opposition to their system. So, anything else? Yeah.
If unrestrained growth or perpetual growth is a fundamental principle of capitalism, that's also called cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which I happen to have.
Yes.
And it's not a really good way to live, you know? It doesn't work. Eventually it kills the host. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know enough to know whether capitalism is more than that or different than that, but that is what we promote in our culture. That is our cultural belief, is that growth is wonderful, and it isn't.
Yeah, it's expansion. It's expansion for the sake of expansion. And one problem, that's why I made a lot out of the business of the value systems in the 1790s. If your ultimate value system is simply to expand, then you really have no value system. And that's part of our crisis right now. What do we believe in as a nation? Really, what do we believe in? That we should just have more? You know, that was that famous line in Key Largo with Edward G. Robinson, you know, when Humphrey Bogart confronts him and he says, what is it you want out of life? More. You know, that's not a value system. And a country that's riding something like that, you know, is basically empty at the core.
Is the Dark Ages, in fact, coming about because of our mass apathy? I mean, I understand that we're saying, in terms of Katrina, we were not apathetic. We went down, we took money, we took food, we tried to help these people. But we were apathetic in the sense that we allowed our government to behave in the way that they did without basically saying anything about it. We've allowed our government to do lots of things without any real protest at all on the part of the American people. And I'm wondering if your concept of Dark Ages is in fact predicated on this total and complete apparent apathy on the part of the people to demand more.
Yeah, I would say it's not the only factor, but it certainly contributes to it. But the thing of living in a world in which only the individual counts finally winds up at Katrina. That's what you finally get, you know. In the face of repairing the levees, which could have been done in advance, you don't bother. I mean, it's stuff like that, you know.
It's not going to happen again. Yeah, no. If there's a hurricane this summer of the magnitude of that, you know what happened last time won't happen this time.
Right. Well, famous last words. Yeah, I hope you're right. I hope you're right.
I am saying that people are, I'm not saying the motives are pristine, but I'm saying people are getting themselves ready so they won't have to endure that criticism again. You know, I mean the powers that be. They will get themselves ready because they went through a pretty rough patch there. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying.
You may be right, but I'm saying
that's not going to happen again, at least not this summer. Maybe next
time. It's just that what I flashed on when you said that was that wonderful skit from Saturday Night Live, you know, the pseudo-Bush, the guy who acts the part of Bush, and he's giving a speech on how great the great shape the country's in, and he says, let me remind you that there hasn't been a hurricane in 6 months. So, I mean, you may be right, but I'll believe it when I see it. Yes?
I think it's telling that the persistent criticism of your work is that it's pessimistic and it's downer. But to me, it makes me feel not crazy. When I'm always hearing that this is the richest country in the world, the most wonderful country in the world, and I turn on the TV and I see people drowning and starving and living like animals in a sports arena, then I feel insane.
Yeah.
You know, we are, you're right, that's the most persistent criticism. And to me, it's kind of amusing because if there's one characteristic that is quintessentially American, it's optimism. And actually, there are some very good things about that, obviously. You know, there are a lot of good things about it if what you're saying is corresponding to what's actually happening. Otherwise, it's called denial. You know, and the thing is that we are all raised on this. We are raised on Walt Disney and Ralph Waldo Emerson. And from the earliest days I can remember of childhood, I got this business of we're the biggest and the best. There are lots of interesting studies done of surveys, polls taken of Americans, asking them questions about the United States in terms of what's actually happening versus reality. For example, one poll revealed that most Americans believe that foreign aid is 25% of our budget. Now, it happens to be 0.25% of our budget. Most Americans surveyed would say, health-wise, we're number one. We're number 37. That, you know, the Germans call it sein und Schein, which you call appearance and reality. The distance between appearance and reality is very great. It's very hard for us to give that up. I mean, tooth and nail, we don't want to do that. You know, but frankly, if there was any chance of repair or recovery whatsoever, it would be by addressing the reality, not continuing to kid ourselves, I think. You know. Yeah.
I want to go back to a question you've asked several times, maybe rhetorically, that, you know, where are the levers of power? And I feel like part of our angst is that they're not in the hands of the people anymore, which was what this democracy was all about.
Well, you mentioned lobbyists earlier. That would be a much more...
It seems obvious, to me at least, that the power is still, the levers of power are still where they've always been, with the wealthiest people in the world. Mm-hmm. And the wealthiest people in the world are no longer the political leaders of countries. They are the heads of corporations that are multinational industries and businesses that will shift themselves around. They have offices all around the world, and they have more money than most of the governments on the planet. Mm-hmm. And they can influence politics and decision making. They use the governments as pawns to achieve their ends, which is to promote their business, their profit making. Mm-hmm. They affect trade legislation and everything else that goes on in this country, mm-hmm, in order to keep increasing their profits.
Yeah, there's still some state control, but I agree with you that...
Is that not where the levers of power exist today?
Yeah, I think when people are asking the question about that, though, obviously what they mean is, in terms of creating change in this country, what would be the levers of power? So I wasn't, you know, for example, poo-pooing the idea of the new monastic order or something like that. I just said that that's not real power. And the Democrats, to me, don't represent real power. In other words, in terms of change, what would that be? What you're talking about are the conservative sources of power and the status quo. And you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But I think the question was raised in the context of, if you're going to turn things around in the United States, where does power lie? And I don't see it. I mean, it's certainly not Dennis Kucinich. You know, that would be nice, but that's not going to happen. Yes, sir?
What if we did something really Mandela, would we bring up Lenin Peltier, kind of a prison, and make him president?
Well, that, you know, in a parallel universe, I mean, that might occur. I don't know if that would really change things all that much, actually. But, you know, I mean, the whole thing about what I talk about in the post-war period is you've got to be a certain type of person to get into that office, and you've got to say certain things and be willing to defend the national security state. If you don't, you won't be elected. The American people does not want to hear. I mean, James Howard Kunstler, who's an urban historian, and I quote him a bit in a chapter I have about urban history, made the remark that Americans would vote for corn-pone Nazis before they'd give up their SUVs. And this is sad, but my guess is that a revolution from the right is a lot more likely in this country than a revolution from the left. We do not have a viable socialist tradition. We don't have one.
Is that what you want?
Well,
I mean, is that what could have saved us?
More of a social safety net. I mean, I'm not, for me, for example, the Soviet Union would be a horrible model as an alternative. I had no interest in a Soviet model. But as I mentioned earlier, Scandinavia appeals a whole lot more. And just in terms of basically people have a lot of protection.
Well, you know. It just doesn't seem like, it seems like some minor adjustments would take care of. I mean, universal health care, for example, sounds major.
It is.
But lots of industries, lots of businesses love the idea because that means they don't have to pay directly for health care.
I heard they hated the idea because it was going to come out of their pockets in one way or the other, and that they're largely opposed to it. In fact, they've been canceling health benefits and pensions.
Moving to states where the states take care of more. More care of health.
Oh, when the states cover.
You're talking about shifting it. Right.
Shifting it to a government entity where they do not have to foot the bill, and therefore, you know, that's a relief.
Yeah, my answer is that if it were that easy, it would have happened. We got a situation where at least 45 million people have no coverage at all. You know, that number is probably growing. I mean, I'm guessing that number will increase over time. So it you know, again, going back to the case of Bismarck's Germany, in 1971 there was more protection for those citizens than we have in 2006. How is that? If it's so easy to make these differences, how is it that the New Deal really didn't turn us around? We stand for certain things, and we did from the very, very early point. We're not going to change those things. A lot of those things were very wonderful and very powerful. But they are now digging our grave, and we can't seem to turn the corner on them. That's the problem.
Isn't it possible that one of our major mistakes was giving individual rights to corporations, to give corporations the same rights as the individual?
Yeah, that happened early in the 20th century.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And at that point, then...
Right, that was a disastrous mistake. Right. But the thing is that it's not an accident. When I say mistake, it's a mistake, but not an accident in the sense that the American ideology is one of the individual comes first. Even if that would apply to a corporation or a church, right? The individual always comes first. So finally you get Katrina, and you get the philosophy that basically on the basis of our notion of democracy, we can invade other countries and rearrange their governments or do whatever we want. You know, I mean, individualism, I can't think of a single thing, whether, you know, philosophy, whether it's individualism or anything else, when taken to an extreme, winds up in a good place. So there are obviously very positive features about individualism. Taken to an extreme, you're in trouble. Well, I think we're probably done. Thank you very much for coming.
You were listening to Morris Berman speaking about his most recent book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. The talk was given last spring in Charlottesville, Virginia. Berman is a visiting scholar in the sociology department at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. Meanwhile, let's check in on the current American imperial project known as the creation of democracy in Iraq. This article from Wednesday, August 23rd, from Reuters in London, titled, Oil Majors Maneuver for Prime Position in Iraq. The world's top oil companies are maneuvering intently to win a stake in their oil field of choice when Iraq finally opens to multi-billion dollar investment. From a safe distance, multinationals are poring over data from Iraq's most promising oil fields and some of its older workhorses to gain the edge when the bidding begins. Iraqi oil minister Hussein al-Sharistani has signaled the race for oil field deals worth $20 billion could start this autumn. But oilmen, noting a lack of security and investment law, are under no illusion that drilling is imminent. We've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes and are ready to act quickly, but under the right conditions, said a senior Western oil executive. At this stage, there is an effective short list of key oil fields and players. It's been a natural selection. Iraqi officials are at pains to insist their country's oil fields, home to the world's third largest reserves after Saudi Arabia and Iran, have not been assigned in advance. They want a transparent process where the best bid wins, and are fully aware of the desires of the majors Shell, ExxonMobil, BP, Total, and Chevron for Iraq's cheap and easy to produce oil. "Of course we know what they're interested in," said a top Iraqi oil official. "The problem is, when can it happen?" Over the past 3 years, scores of firms have signed up for technical studies and training programs that grant them regular access to oil ministry officials outside Iraq, which is on the brink of a civil war. Iraqi officials are using the experience to identify potential partners. A few have not passed muster. "Those who've got acquainted with us will be in a much better position when we open up," said the Iraqi official. The majors are scrutinizing data on some of the biggest gems in the south, vital to Iraq's future oil wealth, and have made recommendations on production policy for certain fields. Some have a wealth of information gathered when Iraq was under a decade of United Nations sanctions. Their spadework may have given them an edge, but Iraqi oil officials say the final competition will be wide open. When fully tapped, it is these southern fields, as well as West Kurna and Halfaya, that should boost production by 3 million barrels per day. Now, relentless sabotage and mismanagement following decades of war and sanctions have left Iraq struggling to pump 2 million barrels per day, after reaching close to 3 million barrels per day prior to the U.S.-led invasion in March of 2003. Multinationals are helping to troubleshoot at the north and south Rumalia oil fields, as well as other problem fields currently ensuring the country's production and exports. "The past 3 years have not been wasted," said an executive at an oil major. "But we won't put our money on the table and our people on the ground until we see more clarity on investment and a vast improvement in security." Those scouring the globe for oil are willing to wait patiently for an opportunity in Iraq, home to 115 billion barrels of proven reserves. Each company is out for itself, but alliances are expected to emerge. "Most likely there will be consortia chosen to take care of the big oil fields," said Shamki Faraj, Director General of Marketing and Economics. "And the majors, because of their expertise and investment capability, stand a better chance of leading some of them." Iraq's oil minister is hell-bent on moving swiftly to lure foreign cash to rebuild and power the country's economy. A meeting of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries in Vienna on September 11th will provide a venue for further discussions, but a major breakthrough is not expected. "Shahristani may elaborate on our position, but we can't do serious business," said a veteran Iraqi technocrat. "There's no law and order, and we're still working on an investment law." Only small firms, such as Norway's DNO, have dared to venture into Iraq. Executives from major oil companies are concerned by greater uncertainty over resource ownership. "There are so many opposing political interests, it will be hard to get things done when the country is so fragmented," said Saadallah Al-Fathi, a former official at Iraq's oil ministry. "Chaos at the Ministry of Oil and a steady draining away of technocrats with international exposure is also a worry." Many good people are retiring, leaving, or given the dire security, getting killed or kidnapped, said Muhammad Ali Zaini of the Center for Global Energy Studies. Iraq will have to bridge the gap, perhaps with consultants or the help of other national oil companies. That from Reuters, August 23, 2006. Oil majors maneuver for a prime position in Iraq.
I'm gonna buy you lock, stock, and barrel. I'm gonna buy you out, and there is little doubt that I'm gonna make a lot of money. Then I'm gonna get the hell out. Well, the first rule of the market is don't panic, and the second rule is you should panic first. Cause if everybody panics at the same time, then the whole damn stock exchange is gonna burst. This is the game of the market, where everybody's maximizing profit. Money changes hands by the dictates of demand. Oh, it's stupid, yes, but nobody can stop it. Well, the price of stocks is rising, it's a record. We can dance and drink martinis on the porch and pretend our profits do not come from sweatshops and that those voluntary standards are enforced. You know that people everywhere, they want our products. If they're sick and poor, we'll make them rich and well. But of course, you know, this doesn't always work out. And if those stupid schmucks rebel, we'll give them hell. This is the game of the market, where everybody's maximizing profit. Money changes hands by the dictates of demand. Well, it's stupid, yes, but nobody can stop it. Well, now how can you hold me to commitment? I must be flexible and ready for a surprise. I'm really sorry that your job's been terminated, but the market told us that we must downsize. Does it sound like we've given up our power to an entity that we can't even see? Well, this is not the first time that that's happened. You can learn about the others on TV. This is the game of the market, where everybody's maximizing profit. Money changes hands by the dictates of demand. Oh, it's stupid, yes, but nobody can stop it.
Where I left off in last week's reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, Gatto was analyzing the educational methods that have led to the sharp decline in literacy in America during the 20th century. Gatto sees reading not only as central to education, but to citizen empowerment and thus democracy. We're going to pick up in an area which is rather technical and deals with a change in the methods used in teaching reading, the theories behind them, and where they came from. You can download archived shows in MP3 for previous readings you may have missed at unwelcomeguests.org, as well as all previous episodes of this show. John Taylor Gatto taught in New York City schools for 30 years, winning many awards for teaching excellence. During that time, he became convinced that our system of compulsory schooling was doing more harm than good, and he finally resigned to find answers and to become a well-known advocate for self-directed education and homeschooling. So we continue in Chapter 3 of The Underground History of American Education, published in 2001. Just to refresh your recollection, at the close of last week's reading, Gatto was discussing a technique of whole-word reading developed by Friedrich Gedecky, a director of a well-known gymnasium in Prussia. Gedecky's whole word method involved students memorizing whole words rather than learning letters and sounds. It was his belief that once a certain number of words would be memorized, students would be able to deduce how to read subsequent words they might encounter. Gatto suggests that this might work somewhat in a supportive environment, but is ill-suited to what he called the meat grinder classroom, a pressure cooker of psychodrama, that he describes as follows. Wherever children are gathered into groups by compulsion, a pecking order soon emerges in which malice, mockery, intimidation of the weak, envy, and a whole range of other nasty characteristics hold sway. And this environment provides a, quote, bad place to play psycholinguistic guessing games, which involves sticking one's neck out in front of classmates as the rules of language are empirically derived. A method that finds mistakes to be charming stabs in the right direction may be onto something person to person or in the environment of a loving home, but it's dynamically unsuited to the forge of forced schooling. So we pick up with the next subsection titled The Ignorant Schoolmaster. After Gedecky, the next innovator to hit on a reading scheme was Jean-Joseph Jacotot, a grand genius much misunderstood. A professor of literature at 19, Jacotot discovered a method of teaching non-speakers of French the French language, beginning not with primers, but with Fenelon's Telemachus. Jacotot read aloud slowly while students followed his reading in a dual translation, to their own familiar language and to Fenelon's spoken French. Then the process was repeated. After the group reading, each student individually dismantled the entire book into parts, into smaller parts, into paragraphs, into sentences, into words, and finally into letters and sounds. This followed the natural pattern of scientists, it was thought, beginning with holes and reducing them to smaller and smaller elements. Jacotot has a reputation as a whole-word guru, but any resemblance to contemporary whole-word reading in Jacotot is illusion. His method shifts the burden for analysis largely from the shoulders of the teacher to the student. The trappings of holistic non-competitiveness are noticeably absent. Penalty for failure in his class was denial of advancement. Everyone succeeded in Jacotot's system, but then his students were highly motivated, self-selected volunteers, all of college age. From Jacotot, we got the idea anybody can teach anything. His was the concept of the ignorant schoolmaster. It should surprise no one that the ideas of Jacotot interested Prussians who brought this system back to Germany and modified it for younger children. For them, however, a book seemed too impractical a starting point. Perhaps a sentence would be better, or a single word. Eventually, it was the latter settled upon. Was this the genesis of whole-word teaching, which eventually dealt American reading ability a body blow? The answer is a qualified no. In the German normal word method, the whole word was not something to be memorized, but a specimen of language to be analyzed into syllables. The single word was made a self-conscious vehicle for learning letters. Once letter sounds were known, reading instruction proceeded traditionally. To a great extent, this is the method my German mother used with my sister and me to teach us to read fluently before we ever saw first grade. Two flies now enter the reading ointment in the persons of Horace Mann and his second wife, Mary Peabody. There is raw material here for a great intrigue novel. In the early 1830s, a minister in Hartford, Thomas Gallaudet, invented a sight-reading, look-say method to use with the deaf. Like Jacotot, Gallaudet was a man of unusual personal force and originality. He served as director at the Asylum for the Education of the Deaf and Dumb in Hartford. Deaf-mutes couldn't learn a sound symbol system, it was thought. So Gallaudet devised a sight-reading vocabulary of 50 whole words, which he taught through pictures. Then his deaf students learned a manual alphabet, which permitted them to indicate letters with their fingers and communicate with others. Even in light of the harm he inadvertently caused, it's hard not to be impressed by Gallaudet. In Gallaudet's system, writing transmuted from a symbolic record of sounds to a symbolic record of pictures. Gallaudet had reinvented English as ancient Babylonian. One of his former teachers, William Woodbridge, then editor of the American Annals of Education, received a long detailed letter in which Gallaudet described his flashcard method and demanded that education be regarded as a science like chemistry. Mind like matter can be made subject to experiment. 50 words could be learned by memory before introducing the alphabet. By removing the dull and tedious normal method, great interest has been excited in the mind of the little learner. Close quote. Historically, three important threads run together here. 1. That learning should be scientific and learning places a laboratory. 2. That words be learned ideographically. 3. that relieving boredom and tedium should be an important goal of pedagogy. Each premise was soon pushed to extremes. These themes, institutionalized, would ultimately require a vast bureaucracy to enforce. But all this lay in the future. Gallaudet had adopted the point of view of a deaf-mute who had to make his way without assistance from sound spoken language. Samuel Blumenfeld's analysis of what was wrong with this is instructive. Quote, "It led to serious confusions in Gallaudet's thinking concerning two very different processes, that of learning to speak one's native language and that of learning to read it. In teaching the deaf to read by sight, he was also teaching them language by sight for the first time. They underwent two learning processes, not one. But a normal child came to school already with the knowledge of several thousand words in his speaking vocabulary, with a much greater intellectual development which the sense of sound afforded him. In learning to read, it was not necessary to teach him what he already knew, to repeat the process of learning to speak. The normal child did not learn his language by learning to read. He learned to read in order to help him expand his use of the language." Close quote. In 1830, Gallaudet published The Child's Picture Defining and Reading Book, a book for children with normal hearing, seeking to generalize his method to all. In its preface, the book sets down for the first time basic whole word protocols. Words will be taught as representing objects and ideas, not as sounds represented by letters. He who controls language controls the public mind, a concept well understood by Plato. Indeed, the manipulation of language was at the center of curriculum at the Collegia of Rome, in the Jesuit academies, and the private schools maintained for children of the influential classes. It made up an important part of the text of Machiavelli. It gave rise to the modern arts and sciences of advertising and public relations. The whole word method, honorably derived and employed by men like Gallaudet, was at the same time a tool to be used by any regime or interest with a stake in limiting the growth of intellect. Gallaudet's primer, Lost to History, was published in 1836. 1 year later, the Boston School Committee was inaugurated under the direction of Horace Mann. Although no copies of the primer have survived, Blumenfeld tells us, from another source we know that its first line was, "Frank had a dog, his name was Spot." On August 2, 1836, Gallaudet's primer was adopted by the Boston Primary School Committee on an experimental basis. A year later, a report was issued pronouncing the method a success on the basis of speed in learning when compared to the alphabet system, and of bringing a pleasant tone to the classroom by removing the old, unintelligible, and irksome mode of teaching certain arbitrary marks or letters by certain arbitrary sounds. Close quote. A sight vocabulary is faster to learn than letters and phonograms, but the gain is a Trojan horse. Only after several years have passed does the sight reader's difficulty learning words from outside sources begin to become apparent. By that time, conditions made pressing by the social situation of the classroom and demands from the world at large combined to make it hard to retrace the lost ground. Mann endorsed Gallaudet's primer in his second annual report of 1838. His endorsement, Gallaudet's general fame and public adulation, erroneous reports circulating at the time that mighty Prussia was using a whole word system, and possibly the prospect of fame and a little profit, caused Mann's own wife, Mary Tyler Peabody, whose family names were linked to a network of powerful families up and down the eastern seaboard, to write a whole word primer. The Mann family was only one of a host of influential voices being raised against the traditional reading instructions in the most literate nation on earth. In Woodbridge's Annals of Education, a steady tattoo was directed against spelling and the alphabet method. By the time of the Gallaudet affair, both Manns were under the spell of phrenology, a now submerged school of psychology and the brainchild of a German physician. Francois Joseph Gall, in working with the insane, had become convinced that he had located the physical site of personality traits like love, benevolence, acquisitiveness, and many more. He could provide a map of their positions inside the skull. These faculties signaled their presence, said Gall, by making bumps on the visible exterior of the cranium. The significance of this to the future of reading is that among Gall's claims was, too much reading causes insanity. The Manns agreed. One of Gall's converts was a Scottish lawyer named George Combe. On October 8, 1838, Mann wrote in his diary that he had met the author of that extraordinary book, The Constitution of Man, the doctrines of which will work the same change in metaphysical science that Lord Bacon wrought in natural, close quote. The book was Combe's. Suddenly, the Mann Project to downgrade reading acquired a psychological leg to accompany the political, social, economic, and religious legs it already possessed. Unlike other arguments against enlightenment of ordinary people, all of which invoked one or another form of class interest, what psychological phrenology offered was a scientific argument based on the supposed best interests of the child. Thus, a potent weapon fell into pedagogy's hands, which would not be surrendered after phrenology was discredited. If one psychology could not convince, another might. By appearing to avoid any argument from special interest, the scientific case took the matter of who should learn what out of the sphere of partisan politics into a loftier realm of altruism. Meanwhile, Combe helped Mann line up his great European tour of 1843, which was to result in the shattering seventh report to the Boston School Committee of 1844. The sixth had been a plea to phrenologize classrooms. This new report said, "I am satisfied our greatest error in teaching children to read lies in beginning with the alphabet." Mann was attempting to commit Massachusetts children to the hieroglyphic system of Gallaudet. The result was an outcry from Boston schoolmasters, a battle that went on in the public press for many months, culminating on the schoolmaster's side in this familiar lament. Quote, "Education is a great concern. It has often been tampered with by vain theorists. It has suffered from the stupid folly and the delusive wisdom of its treacherous friends, and we hardly know which have injured it most. Our conviction is that it has much more hope from the collected wisdom and common prudence of the community than from the suggestions of the individual. Locke injured it by his theories, and so did Rousseau, and so did Milton. All their plans were too splendid to be true. It is to be advanced by conceptions, neither soaring above the clouds nor groveling on the earth, but by those plain, gradual, productive, common-sense improvements which use may encourage and experience suggest. We are in favor of advancement, provided it be toward usefulness. We love the secretary, but we hate his theories. They stand in the way of substantial education. It is impossible for a sound mind not to hate them." And I've been reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Between Mann's death and the great waves of Italian immigration after the 1870s, the country seemed content with McGuffey readers, Webster spelling books, Pilgrim's Progress, the Bible, and the familiar alphabet method for breaking the sound code. But beginning about the year 1880 with the publication of Francis W. Parker's Supplementary Reading for Primary School and his Talks on Pedagogics in 1883, a new attack on reading was mounted. Parker was a loud, affable, flamboyant teacher with little academic training himself. A man forced to resign as principal of a Chicago teachers' college in 1899 for reasons not completely honorable. Shortly thereafter, at the age of 62, he was suddenly selected to head the School of Education at Rockefeller's new University of Chicago, a university patterned after the great German research establishments like Heidelberg, Berlin, and Leipzig. As supervisor of schools in Boston in a former incarnation, Parker had asserted boldly that learning to read was learning a vocabulary which can be instantly recalled as ideas when certain symbolic signposts are encountered. Words are learned, he said, by repeated acts of association of the word with the idea it represents. Parker originated the famous Quincy movement, the most recognizable starting point for progressive schooling. Its reputation rested on four ideas. 1. Group activities in which the individual is submerged for the good of the collective. 2. Emphasis on the miracles of science, as opposed to traditional classical studies of history, philosophy, and literature. 3. Informal instruction in which teacher and student dress casually, call each other by first names, treat all priorities as very flexible, etc., and 4. The elimination of harsh discipline as psychologically damaging to children. Reading was not stressed in Parker's schools. Parker's work and that of other activists antagonistic to reading received a giant push forward in 1885 from one of the growing core of America's new, quote, psychologists, who had studied with Wilhelm Wundt at Leipzig. James McKean Cattell boldly announced that he had proven, using the tachistoscope, that we read whole words and not letters. Cattell's lusty ambition resounds in his cry of triumph, quote, "These results are important enough to prove those to be wrong who hold with Kant that psychology can never become an exact science," close quote. Until 1965, no one bothered to check Cattell's famous experience with the tachistoscope. When they did, it was found Cattell had been dead wrong. People read letters, not words. It was out of the cauldron of Columbia Teachers College that the most ferocious advocate of whole word therapy came. Edward Burke Huey was his name. His mentor, G. Stanley Hall. In 1908, they published an influential book, The Psychology and Pedagogy of Reading, which laid out the revolution in a way that sent a message of bonanzas to come to the new educational book publishing industry. Publishing was a business just beginning to reap fantastic profits from contracts with the new factory schools. Centralized management was providing a pot of gold for lucky book contractors in big cities. The message was this: children should be taught to read English as if it were Chinese, ideographically. Huey was even more explicit. He said, children learned to read too well and too early, and that was bad for them. Quote, "He must not, by reading adult grammatical and logical forms, begin exercises in mental habits which will violate his childhood," close quote. Huey concocted a novel justification based on Darwinian evolution, jettisoning the alphabet system. Quote, "The history of the language in which picture writing was long the main means of written communication has here a wealth of suggestions for the framers of the new primary course. It is not from mere perversity that the boy chalks or carves his records on a book and desk. There is a correspondence with, if not a direct recapitulation of the life of the race, and we owe it to the child to encourage his living through the best there is in this pictography stage." As many before him, Huey missed entirely the brilliant Greek insight that reading and understanding are two different things. Good reading is the fluent and effortless cracking of the symbol sound code, which puts understanding within easy reach. Understanding is the translation of that code into meaning. It is for many people a natural and fairly harmless mistake. Since they read for meaning, the code-cracking step is forgotten. Forgotten, that is, by those who read well. For others, self-disgust and despair, engendered by a halting process in decoding sounds, sets into play a fatal chain of circumstances which endangers the relationship to print for a long time, sometimes wrecking it forever. If decoding is a painful effort, filled with frustrating errors, finally a point is reached when the reader says, in effect, "To the devil with it." Another piece of dangerous philosophy is concealed inside whole word practice: the notion that a piece of writing is only an orange one squeezes in order to extract something called meaning, some bit of data. The sheer luxury of putting your mind in contact with the greatest minds of history across time and space, feeling the rhythm of their thought, the sallies and retreats, the marshaling of evidence, the admixture of humor or beauty of observation, and many more attributes of the power and value language possesses, has something in common with being coached by Bill Walsh in football or Toscanini in orchestra conducting. How these men say what they say is as important as translating their words into your own. The music of language is what poetry and much rhetoric are about, the literal meaning often secondary. Powerful speech depends on this understanding. By 1920, the sight word method was being used in new wave progressive schools. In 1927, another professor at Columbia Teachers College, Arthur Gates, laid the foundation for his own personal fortune by writing a book called The Improvement of Reading, which purported to muster 31 experimental studies proving that sight reading was superior to phonics. All these studies are either trivial or highly ambiguous at best, and at times, in a practice widely encountered throughout higher education research in America, Gates simply draws conclusions he wants from the facts which clearly lead elsewhere. But his pièce de résistance is a comparison of first-grade deaf pupils tutored in the whole word method with Detroit first graders. The scores of the two groups are almost identical, causing Gates to declare this a most convincing demonstration. Yet it had been well known for almost a century that deaf children taught with a method created expressly for deaf children only gain a temporary advantage which disappears quickly. In spite of this cautionary detail, Gates calls this conclusive proof that normal children taught this way would improve even faster. Shortly after the book's publication, Arthur Gates was given the task of authoring Macmillan's Basal Reader Series, a pure leap into whole word method by the most prestigious education publisher of them all. Macmillan was a corporation with wide-reaching contacts able to enhance an author's career. In 1931, Gates contributed to the growth of a new reading industry by writing an article for Parents Magazine, New Ways of Teaching Reading. Parents were told to abandon any residual loyalty they might have to the barren former older method and to embrace the new as true believers. A later article by a Gates associate was expressly tailored for those parents concerned because children do not know their letters. It explained that the modern approach to reading eliminated the boredom of code cracking. With its finger in the wind, Scott Foresman, the large educational publisher, ordered a revision of its Elson Basic Readers drawn on the traditional method, a series which had sold 50 million copies to that date. To head up the mighty project, the publisher brought in William S. Gray, Dean of the University of Chicago College of Education, to write its all-new whole-word pre-primer and primer books, a series marking the debut of two young Americans who would change millions of minds into mush during their long tenure in school classrooms. Their names were Dick and Jane. After Gates and Gray, most major publishers fell into line with other whole word series, and in the words of Rudolf Flesch, inherited the kingdom of American education with its fat royalties. Blumenfeld does the student of American schooling a great service when he compares the original 1930 Dick and Jane with its 1951 successor. Quote, in 1930, the Dick and Jane pre-primer taught 68 sign words in 39 pages of story text, with an illustration per page, a total of 565 words, and a teacher's guidebook of 87 pages. In 1951, the same book was expanded to 172 pages, with 184 illustrations, a total of 2,603 words, and a guidebook of 182 pages to teach a sight vocabulary of only 58 words. Without admitting any disorder, the publisher was protecting itself from this system, and the general public, without quite knowing why, was beginning to look at its schools with unease. By 1951,
Entire public school systems were bailing out on phonics and jumping onto the sight-reading bandwagon. Out of the growing number of reading derelicts poised to begin tearing the schools apart, which tormented them, a giant remedial reading industry was spawned, a new industry completely in the hands of the very universities who had with one hand written the new basal readers, and with the other taught a generation of new teachers about the wonders of the whole word method. Mute evidence that Scott Forsman wasn't just laughing all the way to the bank, but was actively trying to protect its nest egg in Dick and Jane, was its canny multiplication of words intended to be learned. In 1930, the word look was repeated 8 times. In 1951, 110 times. In the earlier version, O repeats 12 times. In the later, 138 times. In the first, C gets 27 repetitions, and in the second, 176. The legendary children's book author Dr. Seuss, creator of a string of bestsellers using a controlled, quote, scientific vocabulary supplied by the publisher, demonstrated his own awareness of the mindlessness of all of this in an interview he gave in 1981. I did it for a textbook house, and they sent me a word list. That was due to the Dewey Revolt in the 20s, in which they threw out phonics reading and went to a word recognition system as if you're reading a Chinese pictograph instead of blending sounds or different letters. I think killing phonics was one of the greatest causes of illiteracy in the country. Anyway, they had it all worked out that a healthy child at the age of 4 can only learn so many words in a week. So there were 223 words to use in this book. I read the list 3 times and I almost went out of my head. I said, I'll read it once more, and if I can find 2 words that rhyme, that'll be the title of my book. I found cat and hat and said, the title of my book will be The Cat in the Hat. Close quote. For the 41 months beginning in January of 1929 and concluding in June of 1932, there were 88 articles written in various pedagogical journals on the subject of reading difficulties and remedial teaching. In the 41 months beginning in July of 1935 and concluding in December of 1938, the number rose almost 200% to 239. The first effects of the total victory of the whole word reading philosophy were being reflected in academic journals as the once mighty reading Samson of America was led eyeless to Gaza with the rest of the slaves. And I've been reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. If you're impatient, you can read this entire book online at johntaylorgatto.com, Gatto spelled with 2 T's. And for listeners in the Ithaca area, an introductory class in nonviolent communication with Becca Harbor will begin on Wednesday, September 6th in Ithaca. Classes will be held at the Green Star Meeting Room at the northwest corner of Buffalo and Fulton, starting at 7 p.m. The first class is free, the rest on a sliding scale. For more information, contact Becca at 272-4034, 272-4034, in the 607 area code. Or, I guess you could leave a message for her at the Green Star Co-op if you're unable to write this down. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. To help these poor